This is an interview with Dr. Harriet Thorner for the California State College Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Michael Neely at 2411 Myrtle Street, Bakersfield, California, 93301, on February 18, 1981, at 2:15 p.m. This is Session 1, Tape 1, Side A.
I was interested. There aren't that many women doctors, especially in the period that we're talking about, the early 30s. It would be of interest to me to know what your family background is and where you came from, how you got into California, into medicine.
Oh, well, that's not hard to explain. My father was a surgeon and a professor of surgery and obstetrics at Indiana University, and he was a graduate of Columbia P&S and at Mount Sinai for 5 years as a surgical resident and a pathologist. And my mother was an opera and a so-called leader singer. You don't speak of leader singers now, concert singers. And she's Hungarian, he was German. She was born in Hungary, he was born in this country. And they lived in Indianapolis. Well, she was educated in Vienna and Paris in music, and he was educated in this country, and he was born in Macon, Georgia, and I came from the deep south and went up to New York to the University of Columbia, Columbia University. And then they moved to Indianapolis, Indiana, in 1902, and 8 years later I was born, and the weather was very hard, and I was a sickly child with upper respiratory infections chronically, and in fact they didn't think I would live because the weather was very inclement. So they came to Los Angeles in 1914, which was just about the time that the first Great World War broke out between the Kaiser's Germany, as you remember, when the Archduke of Serbia was slain, and this started the whole conflagration. And later on in 1917, we came in to save La Belle France and save the world for democracy. Well, I grew up in Los Angeles until I was 8, then moved to a little hamlet called Santa Maria, which is was then a rural area of about 5,000 people between Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo. And there I went to schools and was going to go to Stanford, where I was enrolled in 1927 and fully intended to be a writer or an artist. But in 1929, a great tragedy occurred, and that was the Great Depression. And I lost a couple of uncles who jumped out of the tops of Wall Street buildings, who were a very wealthy man until the Depression wiped them out. And we, of course, lost everything we had to California. And so it was sort of decided that I would postpone my artistic endeavors and go into something practical. Medicine was not my bent. I wasn't that enamored of it. But I was persuaded by my mother anyway. My father, being a doctor, thought I should go into anything but medicine. She, being a musician, felt I should go into anything but music. So medicine prevailed. It was the most practical. So I entered medical school at Stanford in 1931 and found out that I liked it after the shock of it wore off, and spent 4 years at Stanford and a year internship, and then went down to Los Angeles Children's Hospital.
What year was that now? What year was that?
That must have been in 1935. And while I was down there, I got very ill with scarlet fever, having just had shingles about 6 months before at Stanford. And this was in the pre-penicillin, pre-sulfa days, and I was sick. And I developed an otitis media and a mastoiditis and rheumatic fever, because there was nothing to stop the disease. And I was shipped back to Santa Barbara, more of a basket case. And there I was recouping. And while recouping there and wondering what I was going to do with the shattered remains of my life, because I was too sick to go back and apply at one of the teaching institutions, and I didn't want to stay home. And a friend of mine was a radiologist, and he was from Santa Barbara, and he was a friend of our families, and he was located at a hospital in the valley, in a town called Bakersfield. I'd never heard of it. But he was located there at a hospital called the Kern General Hospital. And that was in end of 1936. And he prevailed upon me to come over and function as a pediatrician there, because they only had 4 residents in the hospital, and they had a lot of work to do, and he thought it would be a good way for me to dry out, get away from the coastal climate. I'd had rheumatic fever then for 2 years, and be a good way to get away and be on my own. I hadn't been on my own for a while. So I came to the valley, and this was just in 1937, in March, 44 years ago, come next month. And I was, of course, trained in Stanford and at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, and had all my rigid training there. And my formats were all quite structured, and the type of patient I was acquainted with was either a blue-collar worker or a laboring class that was certainly different from anything I later on met. I hadn't been at Kern General Hospital very long before I found out that the joy experienced by the then attending staff was not because of my charm, my wit, my knowledge, or my skill, but was the fact that I was flesh, and I was one more body that would be able to take first calls. At that time, the fellows were on first call every fourth night, besides covering their daily services, which included everything. But now, with my coming, I was given the entire pediatric clinic outpatient. I was given the entire inpatient, which consisted of at least 40 beds, and all the newborns. In addition to this, every fifth night I was on first call for the entire hospital, which meant pouring anesthetics for anybody that had to have an open reduction or major surgery. I hadn't done any anesthetics in 3 or 4 years. I hadn't done any obstetrics. I was to cover obstetrics. I was to cover outpatient surgery, which meant a truckload of laborers coming over the then very torturous ridge route. It isn't the way it is now. That was really a 3-hour trip to go across that ridge. And I had an old touring Cadillac that somebody gave me with side isinglass, side windows, you know. Those things flapped all the time. Windshield wipers that didn't work. Well, sometimes they would have wrecks, and 18 or 20 laborers, most of them were Hispanics then, would come in, and they were all cut up. And the man on second call was always careful to disappear completely. We had no idea where he went, and I'd be on first call, and we'd have to call the assistant at hospital administrator to help to help pour the anesthetics, at least help me sew up these people. Or we would find a primipara, a woman having her first baby would come in at 2 o'clock. I hadn't done obstetrics since my senior year in medical school. I can assure you it was a very exciting and learning experience. I'd never been through it. After about a month and a half of that, I packed my clothes and left. I said, I want no part of this savagery. And it just so happened that Al Cox, who was a wonderful man there doing work on Valley Fever then and was working in the health department, came down to Santa Barbara and got me back. He said, you just can't leave. This is a learning experience. You can't leave because you are overwhelmed by it. I'll have to tell you something, a funny experience about being put up in a little cottage just east of the hospital then. Hospital then, I think, had about 250 beds. I was a rather timid child. I wasn't particularly, I was outgoing, but I wasn't one of these great, courageous, heroic gals that could tackle the Kentucky mountains with ease. I was very well protected at home, and my hospital training had been structured and protected. So I was out there more or less by myself, and I'll never forget one night, I had a tap on the door, and I opened it up rather cautiously, and there was an aged man, and he asked me if I'd come in and check to see if his roommate was dead or alive. And it was then that I realized I was living in the old man's home. I didn't know it. Well, I went in, and of course, and verified the fact that his roommate was very dead. He apparently expired from old age. And this was a depressing experience, but I began to see some of the humor of lots of the other experience living with the old men there. Well, I hadn't been there very long when I realized that the work was unsupervised. There were no, for instance, attending men coming out, no professors coming out. You sort of did really what you had to, and you did to the best of your ability. And the assistant superintendent was a Dr. Lambeth, and he was a very fine man. He's now deceased. And the superintendent was Dr. Joe Smith. He's now deceased. His father was also was administrator or superintendent of the Kern General Hospital before him. And at that time, I received a tremendous amount of help from a woman who was the assistant health officer. At that time, the superintendent of the Kern General Hospital was also the health officer of the Kern County Health Department. And the assistant health officer was a woman by the name of Dr. Myrnie Gifford, who was really, and she's now deceased, who was really the person who discovered the of San Joaquin Valley Fever. Let's turn it off a minute. Very well, as I began this service there, therefore, to explain why I had all this responsibility, was to explain that anything under 12 years of age came into my clinic. And I would see the patients as they came in to the outpatient department. They were seldom screened. They were never screened as to whether they were an orthopedic case, a dermatology case, a surgical case, an allergy case, an ear, nose, and throat. There was no attempt to differentiate. All you had to do was to be 12 years old and under, and you got into my clinic. How lucky could you be? So you started at 7 in the morning, and I remember the man that would accept the patients as they would come in, and he would shout down this long hall. It was just like hog calling. And it used to bother me because the nurses also would take the charts, and they would shout for these patients who would sort of lumber up to the desk and ask where they were supposed to go. At that time, I knew nothing about the so-called migrant situation, but I wasn't there long before I was initiated. I was told that there was an influx of strange people who were coming over from a place called the Dust Bowl, which proved to be Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas for the most part. Mostly Oklahoma, because that's why they got the name Okies. And these were people, this was what was told me, who were coming here primarily because Kern General Hospital offered them good medical care, and there they could have their ailments taken care of free. And they could also get work in the farms. So the lab technicians and I became friends, and we would take little rides out on Edison Highway, and there would be nothing but empty fields, sagebrush, and stubble. On either side, there was no cultivation at that time. And we would see occasionally a dotted jalopy, as we called it, the old cars, 1929, 1930 vintage, would be parked on the side of the road, always near a bush. And I didn't know what that was for until later on I learned. Later on, a tent would be erected, and the car would be one side, and the bush would be the latrine. And in this tent-like structure would be a man and a woman, usually husband and wife, and usually a grandmother and grandfather. They brought as many as they could, and a varied assortment of children of varying ages. And we would go out driving on this narrow two-lane road, and we would make bets then how soon it would be before our cases of diarrhea, and at that time typhoid fever would come in, and diphtheria. Because in those days we didn't have perfected vaccines against diphtheria, lockjaw, or tetanus. We had no polio. We had no whooping cough protection. Very minimal. We had protection, but it wasn't as universally accepted as it is now. And so the migrants began coming over, and we would again go and take a ride in a couple of weeks, and we would find either side of the highway just dotted with these old beat-up cars. Some of them had just barely gasped over the mountain and come down by way of Needles and fell into the valley, so to speak, with their all their belongings tied up on the top, beds and mattresses, and there were no cribs, boxes. They were windswept people. There was a leathery toughness about their skin. They were prematurely old. Their eyes were sunk deep into their sockets, and there was a lifelessness about it. Their features were also pinched. Their noses were sharp. Their teeth were often out, so the women often looked 20 to 40 years older than they really were. And as they would walk into the clinic in droves, a long, lean, gaunt head of the household in dirty jeans that hung loosely on a spare frame would come, accompanied by this aged-looking wife, suckling at one infant on a flabby breast. The child might be 2 years old at that time. They suckled because there wasn't anything else to eat. And two or three children hanging on her Mother Hubbard. She sort of wore an old Mother Hubbard. They often came in with bonnets, and they shuffled in their shoes, didn't fit, but they were loose on their feet, but that's all they had to wear. They didn't come in barefoot, but they shuffled in their shoes. They had a peculiar odor about them. It was a kerosene odor. It was a cross between kerosene and hog fat that had been used to fry food, and old body odors. This was very new to me. And of course, their idea of feeding a child was to keep the child on the breast as long as possible, and then to give it table food scraps, which would usually be whatever side of pork that they could get the state to give them on the SRA, which was a state rehabilitation administration, which gave you salt, flour, side of pork, and a little sugar. And these were their staples. The first thing I did was to try to teach them how to be clean, and certainly to boil their bottles, so they didn't know what a bottle was, but to boil their containers for their milk, and to use proper nipples that had been boiled and clean. And I couldn't understand why I had so few people responding to me. Until finally, one sanitarian talked it over with one of his colleagues at the health department, and they decided something had to be done with me. Because it was absolutely unrealistic for me to talk formulas and measuring out Cairo with canned milk and water and boiling bottles when these people who were living out in the dirt and living in cars didn't have enough water to drink, let alone to wash. Finally, the government put up some government camps out toward Shafter. And the people who occupied them didn't know how to use these camps. For instance, they used a toilet to wash out clothes in. They didn't know what it was for. They still went out and squatted outside because that's where they'd always eliminated or relieved themselves. It wasn't until the government finally learned to put camp managers in who were people from the Dust Bowl who had sought to better themselves. And they were able to impress discipline much more than the government, which I guess says bring government back to the states where it belongs. Well, nevertheless, they continued coming over, and the attitude of the hospital staff and personnel was not, would you say, the warmest. If ever there was a scapegoat, I think I can see that I think we had an attitude of contempt at their stupidity, at their ignorance, their poverty, their bad odor, and their frightful cultural gaps in cultural knowledge, without realizing that these are people, we didn't realize, fully realize, that these are people who had been literally blown out and starved out and droughted out from their own land. And they were not the erudite, cultured, intelligent, I wouldn't say intelligent, they weren't the learned people from Oklahoma or Texas that were coming over. These were the people that were sharecroppers and were small farmers in their own states, and there was nothing there to take care of them except these advertised promises of help out here in this country.
Did people actually advertise?
I think this is what I understood from what they would tell us, that people would come over from the valley and would tell them there is work over here. Now, as to whether you saw an advertisement, I never saw any. But they were led to believe that this was a land of milk and honey. It was the Canaan of the migrants of the Old Testament. And they came over. They were... I'm trying to remember whether they were particular. They were. I wasn't so interested in religion at that time, and I'm not aware of the fact that they were particularly religious, but I think that they had some hard line religious principles by which they lived. But they had a code of life and a code of sexual life and a code of social behavior that was very peculiar to them.
Could you describe it?
Yes. And the problem of incest, which is, of course, taboo, they brought within the closeness with which they had to live, for instance, in some of the camps. It was not unusual when I went to some of the camps. Oh, I forgot to tell you that the sanitarian felt that it was a good idea for me to learn a little bit more about life than what I'd learned at L.A. Children's and at Stanford. So he and his colleague took me out, and while it was a superficial experience, I didn't really live with him, I saw how utterly stupid I had been to talk unrealistically. It wasn't so much stupidity, it was just naivete, that I didn't realize that I was talking a language that the migrants did not understand at that time. They were terribly poor. They were still poor as they stayed here. And if it hadn't been for the SRA, State Rehabilitation Administration, helping them, they literally would have starved. That and the Kern General Hospital, which provided them often a roof. So it was utterly stupid for me to talk to them about formulas when they were lucky if they could get a little bit of bacon, of pork grease, and mix it with a little milk flour, with a little powdered milk and water and flour, and make themselves gravy and have biscuits and gravy. And incidentally, when you make biscuits, I remember going over in Torrey Oildale, and there was a camp called the Hoover Camp, settlement camp, which had a lot of migrants there. And it was just where 34th Street runs into North Chester. And the camp sort of dropped off the road, just like there was a gully there. And so I dropped by there one time to see how they were living, and I saw them bed after bed in the little tents with the man who should have been working, but he had no work to do, was just lying there with his wife or with a woman, and there would be a grandmother there making flour and water and salt, making biscuits over a little open fire, and I thought that was nice. She was putting currants in there. That was great. What I didn't realize at the height of summer, that some flies got in there, and her vision wasn't so good. And so they worked themselves into the biscuits. But, of course, that's one way of getting your protein, you know. And after you cook, you had sterile flies in biscuits. As for controlling the population, there was nothing much. We didn't have birth control methods then, and certainly no education for it. All we could do is say you should not have so many children, which was the most stupid, hollow thing you could ever tell them, because there wasn't anything else for them to do all day long, most of the night, except to have sex with each other. And as a natural outcome, children would come. So it did no good for me to rave and to rant. Didn't do any good for me to lecture on them about propagation and to explain to them that they couldn't take care of what they had. There was only one thing to do, was to have sex, and then the children came and somebody would take care of them. In the matter of incest, because of the close living conditions and the very little supervision of the fact that often a mother and a father would go out trying to find work, and they would very often take the children with them. But sometimes a girl would be left at home, 11 or 12-year-old, and a brother would come in and have sex with her or bring his friends in. And very often a father did. And in some instances, this was not viewed with as much abhorrence as it is in our present Judeo-Christian community. In some of the cultures, it was felt that this kept the progeny within the family, and that the girl who was sexually invaded by her father was at least having sex with someone who had her best interest at heart, who knew her and could take care of her. And I remember one time having to deliver a mother in one room, and in the bed next to her was her daughter, who was also giving birth. It was a very excellent timing to her first baby. And standing outside the door waiting to find the results was the father of both the infants, who happened to be the father of the young adolescent who was giving birth, and as well as his wife. And that was not regarded with any great abhorrence or as a sin.
How did this affect you personally, coming from such a different background? Were you just amazed or shocked? No,
it's a funny thing you learn in medicine when you grow in the field. You either learn how to be very non-shocked, or you suppress it. I think there are many people in related medical fields who appear very sanguine, who actually have buried long since any feelings of shock or abhorrence. And I think the fact that we had such a volume of patients made me calloused. It wasn't that I was inhuman, but I began to adopt the same attitude in the hospital situation, the cattle call attitude. These are some more of these people who don't keep clean. They propagate. They've come here to take advantage of the hospital situation. And then later on, a welfare system, the AF, aid to families of
dependent children.
Yeah, AWHMA, something like this. It was comparable to our welfare program. And that happened in the early 40s. There was a sort of a contempt.
Sounds to me like you were probably tired as well.
I was exhausted, and there was absolutely no flicker of responsiveness from these patients. It was almost as though they expected to be taken care of. And whenever that happens, the person who dispenses the gratuity becomes indifferent to the sensitivities and the nuances of interpersonal relations, which you develop as you get older. And you actually feel that as the person who dispenses these gratuities, that you are being put upon, you are being taken advantage of. People are not really wanting to go out and do an honest day's work when they can get a handout.
Well, when it started, or when you first started, did the caseload gradually increase?
Oh, yes. And the caseload increased because I was the only sucker that would take care of anything under the age of 12. So all the other doctors who had previously been taking everything were more than happy to send this vast number of children. And then, of course, the population increased as they were coming, as more and more people were coming from a totally deprived area. It was blown to a cinder in Texas and Oklahoma. The thing that struck me about the people was wherever they went, they carried their eating customs, their cohabiting customs, their health customs, which were very primitive. They had very little trust of doctors, but yet they came to us when they needed us. They didn't trust a woman doctor too well, but then I was the only thing they could have, so they learned to trust me. Babies would sometimes be brought in dead, or almost dead, because they would be kept out in the field, so to speak, and would not be brought in. Sometimes they would be starved. I'm sure I saw cases of child abuse and didn't recognize it as such. Blamed it on the circumstances in which they lived. But I'm positive that when life became so grim and just a matter of having enough water and food to keep body together, let alone soul, I think the child abuse probably was very prevalent, and I just didn't know it. In fact, child abuse as a term wasn't recognized as such until 1962, and I'd already been here there for a good 25 years.
What was the most common thing that you saw come into the hospital?
Starvation, malnutrition, filth, utterly filthy, and profound ignorance of any hygiene, health habits. They brought with them many of the customs that had been handed down for generations of health. For instance, one time I was called and I went out with the sheriff's office because there was a child supposedly dying out in the fields, one of the locations, not a government camp, one of the places where they had camped. And the child was very sick, and one of their customs was that you buried a child up to its nostrils as some form of a health procedure. I don't know what they attempted to accomplish by that. Another child had whooping cough very badly, and it was a terribly hot day, about 112, and there was no cultivation out there to cool the environment at all. And this child just been laid out on a board, and they had some idea that laying it out exposed in the full sun would cure it. Well, of course, it died. It was went into heat stroke. We had a lot of children coming in with heat stroke. I remember later on when I went into private practice, and then I began seeing a different grade of migrants, and a good grade of migrants came over and who had later on stayed on and distinguished themselves and became outstanding community residents. But I remember hearing about a very brilliant child, excuse me, in the schools, and the schools were just ecstatic about this little boy. He had such a high IQ, and he was so interested in his work. And then one time he just disappeared, and we followed him up, and the family said, no, we needed to have him work in the fields. And there was no amount of talking to them that would make them change their minds. They felt he was much more important that he migrate with them up into the Salinas area when the grape picking was through here. And it was more important that he go with the family and work in the fields.
Did the tremendous increase in population and the kinds of problems that they brought, did they affect the entire hospital that way? Did they overload the hospital?
I wouldn't say it was overloaded, but I would say a good 60% of our business was the migrant population.
What about other migrant groups? Were they a problem at that time?
What do you mean other migrant groups?
Mexicans or...
No, they weren't. There were Hispanics or Mexicans, but nothing compared to the number, to the tremendous influx of people from the Dust Bowl area, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas, Georgia.
At what time did that reach its peak?
I think about the time I was there, about 37, 38.
And then it gradually decreased.
Then it leveled. Word got back to some of the families there that there wasn't that much work here for them. But they still kept coming because whatever little we had here, it was better than what they had over there. They still kept coming.
Could you say the war was a breaking point for it?
I'm trying to remember. You know, by the time the war began in 41, wasn't it?
I think it was declared in 42.
42. That's right, December 7th, 42. I was in private practice, and I wasn't coming in contact with the migrants because at that time, Kern General Hospital was strictly a charity hospital. And that's where all the patients went. And the residents, whatever residents that they could recruit, very difficult to get residents then. There was no intern training program, and as a result, residents from good hospitals weren't about to go and spend time getting their requirements for certification or specialty training in a place that wasn't supervised by specialists. But the wealth of material, of medical material, was fantastic, particularly in coccidioides, because at that time we only had skin tests by which we could identify them. And the mode of treatment of coccidioides was very limited. The doctors in town, private doctors and doctors out at the hospital, were treating what was called the bumps, the valley fever bumps, which you very rarely see now. Those were large, painful nodules, mostly on the legs, shins, sometimes on the arms, but often on the face as well. They would be very painful, very red, and tense and tight, and they would most often happen to individuals who were newcomers to the valley after they'd been here anywhere from 2 to 6 months and worked in the fields chopping cotton. That's when we could almost predict when cotton chopping season started, we would see what we call San Joaquin Valley fever bumps. They used to be called desert bumps. We would see these cases come in. Now we don't see this form of invasion of the spore anymore.
What was the course of the disease?
The course of the disease, very much like it is now. We had fatal cases of it in the dark-skinned people, in pregnant women in the last trimester of their pregnancy. And their deaths usually would come from invasion of the more innocuous form called the primary pulmonary form of valley fever to the tertiary or the advanced state in which the fungus somehow or other got out of the lungs, where most people get it and heal, got out of the lungs, got into the system, and invaded any organ in the body. You know, when I went to medical school, they used to say syphilis was the great imitator. Well, you could now say that coccidioides imitis, I-M-M-I-T-I-S, was the great imitator because it imitated cancer, it imitated any skin disease, heart disease, anything you could imagine could be imitated by coccidioides. And we had no treatment for it.
And they didn't bring this with them. It was something they contracted here?
It was first found to be very endemic here in this valley. Later on, researchers, and I'm sure if you would talk to people like Einstein and Dr. Holman and Dr. DeFady, they will confirm that they found it in the Panhandle in Texas. They found it in Imperial Valley. And I think they found it in other parts of the western states. But here is where we had the most cases.
Did they make a permanent change on the way that the hospital operated?
No, except that we had to finally expand and get more beds. Appropriate more funds to build more beds, which is how come the West Wing was built, which later on became our pediatric floor.
I was interested in, I know I'm going back, but you were talking about the customs, these things like burying people in the ground and like laying them out on the board.
The children, huh? I have no idea. I didn't ever find out why they did it. This may have been peculiar to a family or a group of families. Usually when they had people that were very, very sick, they brought them into the hospital.
Were there other customs like that that you observed?
I'm trying to think now.
What about home cures and home remedies? Did you have any?
They had a lot of poultices that they would put on conditions, for instance, when you had an abscess in the skin or an abscessed ear, you would have a risin, R-I-S-I-N, or something that was rising. And for these risins, they would invent all sorts of poultices that the grandmothers and their mothers had taught them to use, to apply to them. And they would instill goose grease into the ear. Or animal fat, you know, not goose grease, but any animal fat, chicken fat, into the ear that was supposed to be helpful.
Was it?
I don't think so. It just confused us when we tried to look in the ear, and we couldn't tell whether we were seeing a ruptured drum or a lot of goose grease. And besides, it smelled bad.
What about herbs and like teas? I've heard senna tea mentioned.
Let me see. They used alfalfa tea a lot for whatever ailed you. They never discussed these customs. I can't remember them. I don't know whether I just didn't pay any attention to them or whether this just slipped my memory. I know I'm not giving you something that's very pictorial or very characteristic of that era, and I wish I could tell you more. I'll tell you a funny story. I think it was funny. It wasn't funny at that time. But as a nursing student, a young man was brought in who wasn't too bright, and he had a problem with elimination. He would have a fecal or a bowel elimination every 6 months, and his mother would never evacuate him. And when he got sufficiently distended, so he looked like he was about 8 months pregnant, carrying quintuplets, his mother would bring him in. And at that time, the residents had a quaint custom that the newest resident was given the task of cleaning that kid out. And when I came in, I was the newest resident, and I didn't know what I was in store for when they called me into the outpatient clinic on the adult side, and they said that they needed me. And when I saw this immense boy coming in, and with this sort of mother with a simpish smile on her face, because she had this happen so many times, I learned that I was supposed to put on elbow-length gloves and manually evacuate him. I promptly said I quit. Whereupon the assistant administrator, who was a very good friend of mine, came down, and he said, "I don't blame you." He said, "We'll let you give the anesthetic." And I said, "I'll pour, but I won't clean up." Well, we had to give him an anesthetic every time. And actually, after manually evacuating him, a long hose was put in. And I don't mean a little enema tube, just a long hose. And it would take several hours and a much malodorous clinic to get him evacuated. He had Hirschsprung's disease, which was of long standing. But of course, the family wouldn't consider it surgery, and they much preferred this horrible 6 months ritual.
Were there any other cases that particularly stand out?
Yes, there was a rather interesting one. A young girl came in. She was a 16-year-old girl, and she came in with a problem, and I had taken care of that, and she said, "Would you look at my sister?" And her sister came in, and her sister was a rather dull-appearing child, who was very, very obese, very fat, and she was about 11 or 12. And I had her get on the table, and the sister said, "Well, they were worried because they thought that she had a tumor." Well, I looked at the tumor, and I examined it and felt it, and then I decided to put my stethoscope on it and heard a good fetal heart, decided the tumor was a baby. And so I had to tell the sister that this little 11 or 12-year-old girl was going to be a mother pretty soon. And the sister didn't look at all surprised. And so she says, "I'll get my mother." And so we got her mother. And the mother said, well, she didn't see how that could be. But I said, "Well, it's so." So a short while later, just about a couple of weeks later, the little girl was delivered of a child, a puny child. We could never find out who the father was. The child refused to talk. We don't know if it was a member of the family, if it was somebody that was living there. And then one day I was walking down the clinic, and a lady tugged my sleeve, and I looked down, and it was the grandmother, and she had a little bundle in her arms. And she said, "Will you look at this here baby?" And I looked at it, and it was gray, cold, and it looked very dead. And so I at least went through the steps of examining it, because I thought it wouldn't be fair just to look at the baby in the hall and say, "Your baby's dead." I at least wanted to give the grandmother the benefit of the doubt. And I said, "Well, I'm afraid your baby's dead." And she was very philosophical about it. She said, "Well, maybe so." And so she left with the baby. Whatever happened to the 12-year-old girl, I don't know. Those days you didn't report things as possible incest or as sexual abuse. Remember, that was in 37.
But that was the baby that you delivered of the girl?
No, no. That was another child.
Oh, another one.
No, that was another girl. Oh, that was girls about 14.
I'm sorry. Was there any particular strength that these people had? I can't imagine people persisting in the face of that kind of adversity. Was there something that you saw that seemed to keep them going? Why would they?
I decided that they kept going and didn't succumb because they'd reached the bottom of the barrel and there was no place to go but up. They had nothing to lose by staying here. And whatever it was better than what they'd left. And health-wise, I marveled that more of them didn't die. And I finally figured out that they were so emaciated and lived on such slim rations and were in such poor physical condition that even the bacteria gave up and left.
That might be.
Yeah.
They actually didn't present a proper environment.
That's right. That's right. In those days, we had a lot of cases of meningitis. We had cases of syphilis. We had a very active anti-syphilis clinic run by Dr. Buss, who's now left town. He's retired. He was at that time a resident at the hospital, and he was very interested in public health and in venereal disease, and we had a lot of venereal disease there.
Was it just in the migrants, or was it the population in general?
I think it was the population in general, but most of our patients were the migrants.
I see.
We had a tremendous migrant population.
What did you do for it?
In those days, we treated with whatever was currently used. Penicillin hadn't become, I don't think, that universal, that useful to us. We had things like sulfur drugs. We still had mercury and bismuth and arsenicals.
Was that an effective treatment?
It was the only thing we had.
What did it do?
It delayed the process, and arsenicals, you know, the famous 606 Alvarsan that was discovered in the 606th experiment of, not his name, the great discoverer of arsenic for the treatment of syphilis, is the only way you can control it.
Were there significant side effects to that?
Sure. Especially when you got out of a vein. That was particularly upsetting. You get sloughs. But the side effects of syphilis were so much greater.
Was there a lot of untreated syphilis?
Not if we could help it.
Well, obviously, if you saw...
If we knew it, if we knew they had syphilis, we'd get them in by law. We had a lot of tuberculosis. A lot more. That's how come Keene and Stony Brook were so full. A lot more tuberculosis than we have now. I mean, we have tuberculosis now, particularly since the influx of the people from East Asia.
But now you mentioned...
And Mexico.
Keene, and what was the other place?
Stony Brook. Stony Brook was the hospital where you treated the active tuberculosis. Keene was a preventorium, which is where Chavez now has his headquarters.
I didn't know that.
Didn't you know that? Well, that was the only place where you could send suspect TB and rheumatic fever children. We didn't have any treatment, or didn't have too good treatment for strep infection, so we had a lot of scarlet fever. We had a lot of rheumatic fever. And a lot of diseases that the residents never see now. We had diphtheria, we had tetanus, we had scarlet fever, we had measles, polio was rampant. Oh, we had a lot of polio.
In these migrant people?
Of course, more in the migrant than, but they, it would, polio would hit all walks of life, as you know. And we didn't have any treatment except then the Sister Kenny treatment, which are the hot packs and the movement of the legs and so forth.
What?
I'll tell you another good story. This was a goodie. A kid came in, it was a migrant family from Taft. I'm amazed that any migrants went over to Taft, but they did. At least the supervisor from the Taft area sent a message in that I wasn't to dismiss this child until he said so, and then he promptly forgot it. Well, the county supervisors, he's now deceased. I guess they're all dead but me. But and this kid came in, and she had a full-blown case. She was sick, and I admitted her into the hospital per his orders. In those days, you took orders from the supervisors because they ran the whole place. Excuse me. Yeah, they sure did. They said who went in and who didn't go out, and, of course, the superintendent there was very close with the supervisors, and he would tell me who he wanted. Well, Rosemary was admitted. Her name was Rosemary. She was found in the back seat of a car by somebody. That's where they were living. She was sick, and we put her in onto my floor. And in 2 days, she erupted in a full-blown case of hard red measles, for which we had no serum. Well, I had heard that if you gave whole blood from some adult, because most adults have had measles, there were enough antibodies in that whole blood, and if you citrated it sterilely, injected 10 cc's into the muscle of exposed individuals, there'd be enough antibodies in that 10 cc's of blood to prevent them from getting hard measles. Well, we had nothing else, and we didn't know anything about Rh incompatibility at those times that you could set it up that way. So I went out. We had one wing of the hospital, back of the hospital, called the old men's home, G ward. And there the old men stayed who were too old to take care of themselves, and they were sick and old and declining, and they just resided there. So I went out there one time with a big sterile beaker and enough citrate in it to keep the blood from clotting and a sterile gauze pad. Talk about primitive. And I bled an old man there with enough blood to immunize all the kids in my floor that had been exposed to Rosemary's measles. Well, I not only did that, but I was able for the first time to put a big sign saying measles, contagious, keep out, on the doors leading to the pediatric floor, because until that time I'd never been able to keep out the hordes of relatives that would come in at visiting time and stay from 2 o'clock in the afternoon until 8 at night, bringing in all the relatives, hovering around each crib, and I could get nothing done. At last I had a bona fide reason to keep them out. So Rosemary, who had the measles, didn't get the shot. But every kid in there but one was given a shot, and that one was a father that saw me giving his blood shots, and all the other parents had said it was all right. And he said he wasn't about to have his kid immunized this way or touched that way. He wasn't going to have, I don't know what he was, a Jehovah's Witness, that was it. No blood of anybody else was going to go into his child. Well, that kid came back in 10 to 14 days, so sick with measles we nearly lost her. It still didn't convince him. The child developed a measles meningitis and went out with brain damage. In those days, our diseases were very, very hard, terribly hard, and our whooping cough was awful. We had children that would just die with whooping cough, and we had not enough good antibiotics to treat the pneumonias that would complicate them.
That was a question I was going to ask you earlier. It would seem to me, based on other people I've talked to, that you may not have seen cases until they were so far advanced that they would be very difficult to...
That's right. That's right. A set of twins came up down from, I think, Kernville or someplace, and I couldn't tell if they were alive. I had to put a mirror over one of their mouths to see if any mist was on it. They were as dead, you couldn't even get a heartbeat.
Did they die?
Yeah, one died. Oh, I'll never forget that the worst diseases we always had with all of them was diarrhea. It was unbelievable. We had nothing much to treat them with. Intravenous fluids weren't, nor the material to put in the DDWs and DDW5s and the Ringer solutions. We didn't have that in those days. And to treat them was a hopeless thing. What's more, with the parents hanging over them who didn't like needles stuck into them. And we had just primitive rice water and weak tea, and very often the families would come in with their own bismuth preparations that they would bring over, or Pepto-Bismol, which we now find out is a very excellent treatment of La Turistas when you go overseas.
Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico.
So it actually was an effective...
It was, but those days we were very, very leery of anything with bismuth because we felt it was toxic. Bismuth was a heavy metal.
Was it the same thing with the adults that you treated?
I didn't treat adults.
Oh, that's right. That was the answer. Why did they get this diarrhea? Just malnutrition?
Number one, their sanitation was poor. They had to tote their water. That's an expression I learned from living amongst them or working amongst them. They sometimes had to tote their water in their jalopies or carry it 5 miles. There was no boiling of utensils. Their toilet hygiene was terrible. It was a bush or any outside place. Children played in the dirt. They ate dirt. And they're close quarters. They passed infections back and forth to each other. And they were such poor specimens when they were born. They weren't nice, chunky, 10-pound or 9-pound or 8-pound babies.
What about the camps? You said you visited a camp. Could you describe it physically?
It's hard for me to remember now. I just remember a lot of tents now on concrete bases, some with wooden floors, and forever that odor of old kerosene heating lamps, heating stoves, and grease. I can never get that odor. Dank hair, lank, spare frames, and possibly one room. I'll never forget a funny experience I had after I started practice. There was a woman who was gifted in dressmaking. I learned about her from a couple of friends of mine, and some of the best people in town were going there to have her make clothes. She was an inspired seamstress. She was an Okie, or a migrant. She and her husband lived just north of that Hoover camp, just right off the side of the road, and had a nice little house. And I think the state rehabilitation was taking care of the husband, and he was a plasterer, and he had a little income from what the state gave him. But her genius at sewing was, she was a couturier. You could take a picture that you cut out of the LA Times, show her this garment, and she would make a paper, a butcher paper copy of it, fit you a rough design one day, fit it on you the second visit, and on the third visit you have a finished product. So one time I came out with some material and another picture for her to make an outfit for me, and she said, "I'm not making this anymore." And I said, "Why not?" She said, "Well, they tell me we'll get off of SRA if I do, and my husband says I can't do it because we need the money from SRA. And yet she had within her the potential to have been set up in business, to have made 20 times what she ever made on SRA. The motivation was so minimal in the people, as with this family that took this brilliant child out of school to work in the fields. We couldn't induce them to let their child do something better with himself than be a cotton picker or a fruit picker.
Did you establish a long-term relationship with any of these children?
One of them, yes. He's dead now. As was the custom of many of these people, they came in and they didn't have first names. They had letters. And his name was, well, we'll say J.C. J.C. Smith. That isn't his real name. And he, by that time, I'd been in practice about a year or two. It must have been around 1941. And this boy was neat and clean and attractive-looking child. Parents were so nice and clean. And he had come in on a jalopy, and he had driven, I think, down from Barstow down to here, holding the top of the dresser or the bed on their pickup, or their, not, they didn't have pickups in those days, but a truck. And he came in with a complaint that he was having some weakness in one of his arms. And I wasn't able to figure out what his problem was. And I had a specialist who was at that time coming up to Kern General Hospital, because by then we were having paid specialists coming up in plastic surgery and orthopedics from Stanford and from Los Angeles Hospital. And this boy was operated on, and he wasn't getting any better. And finally, I sent him up to Stanford, and there they diagnosed him, and he had a rare degenerative condition of the spinal cord called syringomyelia, S-Y-R-I-N-G-O-M-E-L-I-A, syringomyelia, I think. And over the years, as he grew up, he was only 12 when I saw him, and he developed a great fondness for me and I for him and his family. And he was determined, despite the fact that he was deteriorating by millimeters, first a little bit more muscle of his foot, and then his hand, and then his back, and then later on his speech, and he was determined he was going to sell real estate. And he didn't pass his test, but he learned his lessons very well. He was bright as a dollar. His mother later on married, was widow, she was married when she came, and her husband died, and then she remarried, and apparently married fairly well. This boy deteriorated neurologically, but he never gave up, and he wanted so badly to work in a real estate office because he could sell anybody anything. But they had a funny law here in the state that you couldn't get your license until you had first had a sort of an apprentice, an internship. And yet the realty offices wouldn't give him a trial unless he had his boards, unless he got his had passed his test. And so here he was between the rock and a hard place. He couldn't get his boards because they wouldn't let him intern there. And it was because of his handicap. And he was such a plucky kid. And he finally died 2 or 3 years ago in a nursing home. And he couldn't have been more than 46, 48.
But you followed him that
time? All that time. He was a dear boy and a precious boy. Even in the times before he wanted to be a realtor, he got himself a banjo and then a guitar, and then he composed songs and found some outfit in Los Angeles that would make recordings like our rock music people do. He had that much spunk and initiative. But he was the exception of the patients that I saw. Most of them have very little motivation.
Do you feel, looking back now, that experience contributed to your own life experience?
Only in that it made me much more understanding of people. You don't judge a whole culture by the people who are driven out by poverty and ignorance and who are destitute. We categorize the whole state of Oklahoma and Texas and the southern part of the United States by these people who came and had the very, very poor people of California drifted up to Washington and Oregon to pick apples. I'm sure they would have been called Calis, because they weren't any less dirty and any less ignorant and any less disease-ridden than these people who were literally blown out of the southern part of the United States.
Were there any of these people that made well that you know, or did well?
Oh, yes, I've heard of quite a few that have become very successful in this community and other communities. In fact, the sanitarian who decided somebody ought to pin my ears back was himself a family that had come over from the Dust Bowl area.
Was it surprising, I don't mean only to you, but also to others of your associates, that some of these people made well? Did they?
I never talked it over with my associates, because it was only until later on in life that I, in retrospect, that I began to see this in a much larger scale. Mm-hmm. That this was a migration. It could have happened to me had I been driven out, poverty-stricken, deprived of my clothing, my sanitation. And had I never known anything other than living in a poverty-ridden situation, I wouldn't have been any different.
I don't know whether this is a fair question, but are you able to compare the migrants from Oklahoma with migrants from other areas that you've encountered? Do you see any similarities?
Only in that people who migrate, as the so-called Okies did, I call it this because that's how you classified people,
that's
came from the Dust Bowl area. Well, the first ones to come over this way will be those that are driven by sheer poverty and who have always been poor, even in their own country from where they come. And with the Hispanics or the Mexicans, the first ones that we see and that we deal with are those that were so poor in Mexico and ill. The same situation obtains now with many of the Mexicans I deal with almost exclusively now in my work, that many of the illegals, they bring with them their cultural customs, health customs, and you cannot change them no matter what you do. You can't change the macho image of the man. You can't change some of their concepts of how you treat disease early and not accept the customs that have gone on for generations. But the longer they stay in this country, they take back the better sanitation, the better education, the better medical knowledge that we have. And the second and third generations stay here. They demand these things. They come into our well baby clinics. They expect fluoridation to be when you talk to them about it. They know what you're talking about. They want vitamins for their children. They want the immunizations.
Did you find that true also?
No. No. Heavens, no. They were deathly afraid.
We're talking about the Okies. The Okies.
They were deathly afraid. Not just of a woman doctor. They were afraid of that enough, too, because that was not a conventional type of animal. But the fact that there would be anything that would at all interrupt their lifestyle. So that's why they would bring their children and themselves in extremis as a last resort, which made it so impossible sometimes for us to save them, which would bear out their contention that when you went to the hospital, you died.
And you didn't feel that they, as the other migrants you were describing, that they gradually began to demand these services, but they continued?
Sure they did. Sure, the migrants, as they stayed here and got businesses and became located, of course they learned these things. I would have done the same thing if I'd been a migrant wandering all over the country. And some of them were more motivated than others. It's true in people who stay right here for generations, friends of yours, their children. You look at the children of your friends, some are terribly motivated and some couldn't care less. So the poorest people came over and then better people came over because the better people had a little bit more to keep them going in their own country before they had to leave.
Did you run into any instances of midwifery in the migrants in the camps?
I'm trying to remember. It could have been.
I know you dealt with the children.
It could have been, but I can't remember now. I can't remember.
What about maternal childbirth or maternal deaths involving childbirth?
I don't remember hearing of that.
I've talked to people.
You have to talk to people like Dr. May, who might be able. Dr. May might be able to tell you more because she was here 10 years before I was.
The reason I asked, I talked to a gentleman whose father was a midwife. He said that he
Whose had, mother was a midwife?
No, his father.
Father was a midwife.
I suppose you wouldn't call it a midwife, but that's what he did.
Oh, that's unusual.
And he said he'd delivered all of the children that they'd ever known and, in fact, married one that he'd delivered later, but at the same time, I asked him.
Was he doing that here in Kern County?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I know nothing about it.
And he said that they never had a problem. And I found that hard to believe.
Well, not too hard when you consider that probably most of the women he delivered were multiparous. And I don't think they were having too much contracted pelvis. And I would suspect that the babies weren't too large. Maybe he delivered giants, but most of them were malnourished during their pregnancies. And I would say that they didn't have tremendous babies.
So there wouldn't be that many
babies. I don't think there were, but there were a lot of other illnesses that followed. For instance, a lot of Rh negative problems and erythroblastosis probably that happened. And many of these children, because of their neglect and diseases that were rampant, then didn't live past the age of 5.
You did see a lot of early death that way?
Oh, yeah, they just didn't survive. Nutrition was poor. After all, when a child's on the breast until it's two, and the mother has practically no milk, and the child's just eating what it can.
That must have been very hard for you. Must have been hard to deal with that.
I got frustrated at times, which was one reason why I was glad to leave and go into private practice, see how the other world lived.
It did really just wear you out, seeing that.
You burn out. But anybody that works in deprived areas burns out and needs to have a time to recoup.
Is there any last comment you'd like to make, summarizing, just kind of wrap it up? What we've got is sufficient.
No, I think I've said enough. I think there was a learning experience, and if I had it to do over again, I'd do many, many things differently.
You want to talk about that?
I would have spent more time with the migrants.
In what way?
Living amongst them, not actually taking up residence, but visiting them more often, attempting to talk their language, and to really get into their skin.
Why is that?
I would have had a much, much better understanding of them. I think that I shared the feeling of the institution that this was a necessary evil, and it was a nuisance, and that these people really didn't appreciate what we were doing, didn't comprehend what we were doing, and wouldn't do what we said anyway.
But now with the, from the vantage point of...
Oh, of 43 years later, of course, age mellows you, and you begin to understand that people do the best that they can with what they've got.